हाँ सत श्री अकाल पुत, ठीक है?
Hi mom. I'm just calling to check on Aryan. How is he doing? Is he doing okay?
हाँ बंटी तो ठीक हैगा, आया खेलता हैगा।
Has he had lunch yet?
हाँ
निक, मैं तो कड़ा बना लिया सी।
Mom, कड़ा is not a lunch. Plus, he's dairy intolerant.
देसी घी दे नाल बनाया सीगा। कोई गल नहीं, कोई गल नहीं पुत।
कड़ा is made with ghee derived from butter. Gosh. Okay, how about the quinoa I put in his lunch box?
मैं तो डब्बा खोलिया सी, ओदा कीमा नहीं सीगा ओदे विच, पता नहीं की सी दाने जे, मैं तो कड़ा बना लिया सी।
No, mom, not quinoa. Quinoa, it's a grain. It's actually a grain, but a protein source. It's just really nutritious for him.
हाँ पुत कोई गल नहीं। अच्छा स्टार प्लस का सीरियल शुरू होने वाला है, मैं तो चली हूँ।
लिसन मॉम, वन मोर थिंग, व्हेन द अलार्म अराउंड हिज नेक रिंग्स, इट्स टाइम फॉर हिज न्यूट्रिशनल यीस्ट। मॉम मॉम,
तेरी मम्मी भी ना
आज बेटा रसमलाई खा ला।
Welcome to my podcast, The Sisterhood of Mummy Imperfect. I'm Mummy Imperfect, aka Rena. Now, I just want to say Happy New Year, everyone. It's 2019. This is the first episode of the year. Now, who have I got from Sisterhood to join me today for my panel, Shut the Front Door? I have my very good friend, Rummy, beautiful, intelligent mum of three. And I have my cousin, Gideth, who is a beautiful, intelligent career woman. This is what we spoke about.
So, talking of New Year, would you have you made any New Year's resolutions?
No, I haven't made any New Year's resolutions, but I do because I think they're quite corny, and I'm nearly 40, so I just think it's something that younger people might do. But I do sort of like keep in mind, oh, okay, what do I want to do this year? So I'm doing Dry January, which is awesome, which is quite good. So that's like a resolution, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which is, you know me, it's quite good. Mm-hmm. But other than that, not really. I haven't really got any resolutions, no.
Okay. No. So what about you, Gideth?
I am the complete opposite and have so many resolutions. I just like need to cut stuff out because I'm somebody that I want to achieve so much. And so I'm like, oh, I just put everything down. I also think New Year's resolutions are a bit corny. And so I kind of have mine as like goals for a year.
Yes.
And they kind of extend into several years. And so kind of the way I do it is like I have a bucket list. Mm-hmm. And so that always comes across as a bit kind of a bit more fun. Particularly if you don't think about actually kicking the bucket, like you just think, what kind of fun, exciting things do I want to do? And then I also include like things like family things I'd want to do, kind of social things, career wise. And then I also kind of name each year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I got from a friend of mine. So each year will have a particular name, and it's almost like you have to become that thing or that person or represent that ideology throughout the year as you try to achieve your goals.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't get it.
So for example, it will be, so you'll have the year of something. So like last year, my year, and you can make up words, by the way.
Yeah.
So my last year was the year of the feminist Wifanian.
Right.
So like I made up the word Wifanian,
uh-huh.
Which is like wife and companion kind of mixed together. And then, you know, I'm a feminist.
I really like that word.
And so
Wifanian, yeah.
So I think, and I've been listening to Jada Pinkett's Red Table Talk. Mm. I don't know if you've kind of
seen that.
And she talks about her and Will Smith being like kind of in this everlasting companionship. And I know that there's lots of controversy over being a wife. I'm obviously not a wife. I'm not married, but like, I think it's like, what do you want to be several years down the line and how do you kind of get there?
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's, I try to be like very strategic about what I want long term. And then I kind of have my goals kind of around that. It's almost like when you act and you like role play and you're like, I am going to become this person. Mm-hmm. So you'd be like, I don't know, the year of being bootylicious, and like being bootylicious could be like whatever you want. It could be mm-hmm. as fearless or as, you know, it could just be whatever it is. And so I do that with another friend of mine, me and my best friend. And then every year we kind of get together and we have dinner. We'd like talk about what we've done in the year. And my best friend kind of has actually weekly catch-ups with a group of friends. So they come over and they all talk about what their goals are and what they're doing this week and how far they're getting. I don't do that, but
that is really super focused.
That is
really militant. Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it's not what most people do. And I guess it just depends. I don't know, maybe it depends how much time you have on your hands, because I think one of the reasons why New Year's resolutions actually fail is because they're like, oh, New Year, I really want to change and I really want to be a better person, and then you just pluck something out of the air, and then obviously you come up against obstacles, you know, and you kind of think, oh God, I'm not going to achieve what I want to achieve. And then it all, you know, 3 months down the line, you're not kind of where you want to be. So
by this point, some people might have actually fallen off the wagon already. You know, we're a couple of weeks into it now. So they might have actually been like, you know what, forget that. I'm never going to the gym.
Tradition, isn't it? And it's almost like a joke, or what's your New Year's resolution? But I think what you're talking about, Gareth, is like that's some serious planning and serious goal setting, which is really good. And I really like January. You know, you were talking about gloomy January, and yes, Christmas is over and you know it's freezing and there's no festivities, it's, you know, the long haul, you're like facing 3 months of like what people think is pure misery or whatever. But I love January for exactly what you spoke about, and it's just such a great time to think about, okay, what, and even superficial things then, okay, what holidays am I going to go on? What do I want to do by the end of the year in terms of, you know, with the kids, what do they want to do and how can I make that happen? That's really important for me. Where do they want to go? What do they want to do? What do they want to achieve? Because I'm like their, you know, their enabler. I can set all those things in motion. Career-wise, what I want to do, it's just exactly like you said. So it's a bit more serious than a New Year's resolution. It's actually proper goal setting. And I love that, because I just feel like, oh, the opportunity of January, you know, it's you've drawn a line under the previous year. Whatever happened, whatever you didn't
achieve,
you table it for next year. What you did achieve, you think, great, okay, but now I want to do this. And you just build on it. And also if you had a crap year, sorry for swearing, but you know, you can then just table it and go, well,
definitely. I love January.
I love January. Although it's cold.
Yeah, really, really.
You know what I did this year, which I've never done before. I don't think I've done this before. I do news resolutions, like little ones to do with health and stuff as well, but like you do kind of similar to your goals, like this year I want to do this, and sometimes I don't get through them all and I don't beat myself up about it, but or sometimes I'm moving forward on those goals and then other things happen which I never thought about, but I'm gonna just grab them with both hands. So but I like to have a little bit of structure in place, right, as well as go with the flow. But then what I've done this year is, like, on the 1st of Jan, I actually looked back to last year, and so because I think that I thought to myself, no, I think I'm going to actually look back before I move forward, because sometimes you actually forget what you did, right? And looking back at the things that I did, like we did as a family, and then stuff that I personally did, I kind of patted myself on the back after I did that and thought, you know what, I've actually done some stuff towards my ambitions and little things that had led me in the right direction. And I think that's really important, because sometimes we forget about things, or we're like, oh, but I'm just not where I want to be. And then you just look at all these little things and you'll find that, okay, there's progress that's been made.
Life does, you do go on many tangents. Like, you start off well in January, and like you said, things happen, and you know, you kind of come off your path a little bit and go down another little path, and that's fine because life happens and you have to sort of go with the flow. But then, you know, slowly you come back onto the path and you might have gained things that you wouldn't have thought that you were going to achieve, things that you wouldn't thought that you were going to achieve. And but then the you know, the general gist of what you want to do is there. It's just that you've gone on a few tangents to get there. Sometimes it's straightforward and sometimes it's not. I mean, especially if you've got families and children, and sometimes you just have to put things on a back burner and go, okay, I'm actually just gonna not stress myself, leave it for a month, go and do this other thing because it's more important right now, and then come back to it. So yeah, but I don't think I've really fully assessed. I always come to January and kind of want to forget the last year, but it's quite good to go back and have a look at actually what was good.
I think it's so important to reflect both the good and kind of traumatic times, whatever those are, because you actually learn so much about the strength of your character and also where your learning bits are. I think like the power of social media for me every year. I didn't do it this year because I was so busy that I actually worked through December, but I will be posting it kind of this week, so I'll always post kind of what my year was like. So at the end of the year, so I'll be like, this is what I achieved on my bucket list, and I'll always be very honest about also the difficulties that I faced along the way. So though these are, you know, 10 moments that capture how positive that year was, there was also kind of lots of negatives. And I think the beauty of that is each year I can go back and I can look at kind of what I've achieved, because like you said, it kind of gets put into your memory bank and you kind of forget about some really wonderful things that you've done, and some really courageous things. And I think those can be the things that inspire you in January, which I always say is like my kind of creative month. I think it can really make you think, well, if you did that 3 years ago, why not do something equally as challenging in a different sphere this year? So I definitely think that there could be something with connecting what you achieve with putting that on social media, not only just to talk about the good things, but also the bad things that people actually
To be really honest.
Which it was a wholesome year in so many different ways.
I love the fact that you guys are really upbeat about January, because January, some people hate January so much. Even I'm not, like, January is my least favorite month, to be honest with you. I mean, yes, it's good to set goals and things, but all the tinsel and the sparkle and the glitter has all gone, been packed in boxes now. It's winter now. Winter is just bleak now, and you know, loads of people have overspent at Christmas, gone mad, overindulged. They're probably feeling like a bit crappy, and you know, so it's not good for a lot of people.
No, it's not. It's not. But yeah, and I think it's because, you know, and also people, other people in media perpetuate it as well, don't they? Because it's like, well, it's just drummed into your head that, oh yeah, the blues, January's coming, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then you kind of are looking around, and perhaps even if you're not feeling it so much, because everybody else is, you kind of go, you kind of ride that wave as well a little bit. But I know some people suffer with, like, you know, they have what's that called, seasonal affective disorder, like, you know, they, and it's like, you know, dark very early in the morning, and it's dark you know, when they get back from work. And I've never really suffered with anything like that, thank God. And I don't genuinely get affected by weather that much, unless it's like non-stop rain. But to me, it's just that I was going to say it's a balance, but it's not a balance, because it's cold for about 8 months of the year. It's not really, you know, 8-9 months of the year, freezing for me. But I don't really get affected by that, really. I know, you know, summer's on its way, and yes, it's cold, but you just kind of wrap up. I'm kind of matter of fact about those sorts of things. But people who do suffer from those sorts of, you know, that illness, or just being depressed at this time. Yeah, I guess, you know, I can totally understand that, but it's not something that I've ever felt like.
What about you?
So I think there's the kind of separate issue of kind of people having kind of diagnosed kind of medical issues or you know, depression or, yeah, around this period of time. But generally, I just think, do you know what? It's about you, and it's about how you see this month and the next month and the month after. As I just think that there's always an excuse to be made whenever there's something challenging that you want to do. I think, like, you know, I, for example, have the Lumi clock. So it's like a kind of body clock.
Yep.
Yeah, the light clock. And so that will come on and kind of rise as sun rises, which I think is it's actually a really, really good investment to make. So I think there's small things that you can do. I take like vitamin D tablets during the winter months as well. I also often around this time will book a holiday. So, and I'll go somewhere hot. So next week I am flying to somewhere with much warmer weather. And I think that also can have an impact. So having something to look forward to in terms of going somewhere nice, but also if it's got the good weather where you're getting your kind of vitamin D and your endorphins. So I just think, do you know what, separate to kind of SAD, there's always an excuse to be made. And I think, like, you have to take charge of kind of your own time, your own month, because that time that you're making excuses, you could be achieving some of those goals. So I just think that there's a balance to be made.
I actually, in the past, have suffered with, I wouldn't say it's like sad, the seasonal affective disorder, whatever, but I have felt a bit down in the cold and the grey and stuff, especially like last year, we'd been in India over Christmas, right? And so coming back from India, which was sunny and beautiful and colourful and mad and everything, coming back to grey London, I was actually feeling quite down. I was down for a few weeks. And I really had to make the effort to do something every day which made me feel good, whether it was putting on nice music and dancing around with the kids, making nice food, eating well. Like, you know, like you feel like having, okay, I want to have a treat and stuff, but then if you eat total crap, it makes you feel worse as well. So it's kind of a balance between having nice treats and actually eating things that are nutritious for you. And then hanging out with good people, making sure I planned things, I had things in the diary, people who were good for me and positive and fun to be with, you know, to hang out with them as well. So I honestly, that was when I really felt it. After coming back from India, I really had to make a conscious effort to sort of out, really.
Yeah, so you're actively managing that situation. So because, you know, a holiday is great to look forward to, having dinner with friends, all that sort of stuff. But I guess that would come to me now. I would be very, I'm very aware of those sorts of things, and I need to put those little events in my calendar so that I have got something to look forward to. But I think 10 years ago, I don't know if I would have done that. I think that's, for me, that's come with age, I think, as I've got older and you know yourself a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know, you go through these years and cycles and you kind of pick up on these. Some people are very, pick up these things about themselves really quickly, but I don't. It might take me a few years when I go, oh yeah, there's a pattern here, and okay, I now I know there's something going on, I need to do something about it.
Okay, cool. So now this panel is called Shut the Front Door, which is, and I want to talk about stories that make us think shut the front door, right? So I'm going to talk about some of them now. So the first one is this French author, and he's a presenter as well, called Yann Moi. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's 50 years old, and he has said that he couldn't love a woman who is over 50 years old. So he's been mocked loads on social media, rightly so, right? But what do you think about this? Is he a complete idiot for saying this, or is he just saying what loads of men actually think?
No, I don't think loads of men think that. I don't think so. I think a lot of them might do, but I don't think the majority do. It was a really, really stupid thing to say. And as you can see, like, the backlash that he's had is hilarious. I mean, people have sort of seriously, you know, it's been quite funny, the backlash. It's not been completely like, oh, my God, you idiot. Shut up. It's been quite mocking.
They're
like just completely taking the absolute piss out of him because he's said an absolutely stupid thing. And but I don't think a lot of guys think like that. Yeah, I mean, let's not compare. I mean, yeah, okay, a 25-year-old body and a 50-year-old body, yes, there's going to be huge differences, but you, and huge differences in mind as well. I mean, you can't compete a 25-year-old mind of a woman and a 50-year-old mind of a woman, right?
And no. People that don't know, so he basically said that he finds the body of a 25-year-old woman much more attractive, and his type is like Asian, like Korean, Chinese, yeah. I mean, let's ignore that fact. Okay, that's his type. Maybe he's got some weird fetish, or maybe that's normal. Maybe that it's okay to have a type. I mean, I personally don't identify with that because I've never had a type. I'm always about the people, but I know people do. Fine. Let's focus on the fact that he said he's more attracted to a 25-year-old's body, right? Now, listen, I actually almost had an argument with my lovely husband about this today because I was like, oh, I'm going to be talking about this. And what do you think about the story? And he was like, well, yeah, it's biology. That's biology because men are always going to be attracted to younger women because they can procreate with them biologically. Because, you know, you're a man, you can father a kid at 70, and that you're always going to be attracted to younger women.
I actually somewhat agree with that. I think that the reason why marketing sells so much is because we put young, very slim women, often white women, out in the media who are then glorified and glamorized for the way that they look. And so, and I think that who you're attracted to is, I think who you love and who you're attracted to is all based on like the psychology of desire, which can be controlled. You don't think it can be controlled, but because desire can be so strong, it can push you in all kinds of directions where you're kind of sitting in a prison cell thinking, how did I end up there? But I think that the way that big, large agencies in society that kind of secondary socialize the way that we think is to kind of put out content and images of very young, attractive women. Mm-hmm. Now there are older attractive women, but those kind of images and that kind of attention is never put out there. And you kind of see women who are in the public eye, who are older, who will always do their very best to make themselves look younger.
Yes, there's all the whole industry built on it, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a reason for it. Like, it sells, and there's the kind of money element of it. But I think that there's something kind of biologically related to the way that men think about young women and kind of procreating and beauty and how they match that up in order to kind of continue their bloodline or generations,
yeah,
which they wouldn't see in an older woman. That's not to say I agree with that, but I think that there's something there with older men, and I think both on a psychological level and a physiological level.
Like, let's be clear, we're not talking about like the R. Kelly sicko kind of level here. We're talking about, like, you know, like, yeah, like 14-year-olds. No. We're talking about, like, you know, someone in, yeah, a girl in their 20s having a relationship with an older guy, because then girls in their 20s do that as well, don't they? You will see a lot of guys, and sometimes they are well-established, they are rich, and then they get younger girls who are obviously, I don't know, are they looking for, like, that they could have like a hot 25-year-old, right? Like them. Mm. But they're going for this sugar daddy because of their lifestyle, the security and stuff. Is that a biological thing as well?
Well, they're going for the lifestyle and the like sugar daddies, as you say. They're probably not going for his body. They probably would still prefer, the 25-year-old woman would probably still prefer a younger body than the 50-year-old male body. Which is, you know, which is a little bit different. But yeah, what an idiot.
Is it? But I do wonder, is there something about security that a 25-year-old potentially wouldn't have and a 50-year-old might have, and a woman who is in her 50s and is well established and doesn't need the safety and the protection financially or in any other sense from another man, because she's well established, but actually a 25-year-old would look at that person and be like, these are the things that I need, or I think I need, and I could easily access that in a 50-year-old who actually wants to be with somebody my age as well.
Yeah.
I started getting really annoyed when I had this conversation with my husband, because he was just like, well, yeah, you know, this is what happens, and it's normal, and it's biology. And I honestly was like, I think we should stop talking about this before I actually kill you. I was getting really annoyed, because it's like, well, if this is the case, then are women who are older, like 50-year-olds, are they just invisible to guys then? And, you know, I'm 40 now, and okay, yeah, I might have got good genes and be looking after myself, but I will be 50 one day, and maybe I will look 50. And you know, it's just not nice to know, is it?
No. Yeah. I think on the superficial level, that is, I don't know, it's kind of the norm in Hollywood.
Oh my God. Yeah. And Bollywood as well.
And even Bollywood.
Like, there's a lot of, because I thought it was just Bollywood, because I know that, like, you know, you have actresses like Anushka Sharma, and she made her film debut with Shah Rukh Khan, who was 20 years older than her, and that was normal, and they always do it. And then Hollywood does the same, because you have got like Scarlett Johansson and these other young actresses being cast with the romantic lead that was twice their age.
Yeah, it's an old adage, isn't it? It's been going on for years, basically. So some of the reaction that I watched, you know, just watching bits of daytime TV or just reading the paper, and, you know, this backlash from these older women who'd said, actually, you know what, he's got a point, because you do, after 45, this one woman had called in to say, I was watching the Jeremy Vine show, daytime TV, woohoo, who said that, you know, yeah, you know, at the age of 45, she feels invisible to all men. And so this, you know, there may be some truth in it that, you know, but then people are saying, oh, but what about J-Lo and what about Kylie? And yeah, but we don't all look like J-Lo and Kylie.
No.
You know,
so
there is your average 40, 45, 50 year old women, you know, so.
Yeah. But I think what a woman has, like you were saying before, what a woman has at the age of 25 and what a woman has at the age of 50 can be very different. So
mentally,
the physical sense, you're not what you used to be when you were 25. You've got so much more to give. And I think, like, your energy and your mind is there's a complete shift. And so I think, though you might not be attracting a mate via your body, which you might have done when you were 25 or whatever age, but actually you're attracting a different pool of men, and maybe even the right kind of man through the right kinds of ways now. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if some men are like, oh, I prefer a 25-year-old. Fine, do what you need to do. But actually there's a lot of really intelligent, smart and forward-thinking men that are thinking about having a woman that meets their expectation in so many other ways other than what her body looks like.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about the journey a woman would go through, you know, your average woman from the age of 25 through, you know, to 50, that 25 years, she would have got met someone, married someone, had children, raised those children, you know, those children leave. That's a massive journey. And, you know, what she would have experienced, what she would have, you know, all the things that you let go of, you know, the self-esteem issues you might have in your 20s, you know, you don't feel sure about anything. And when you're 50, I think even actually when you're, you know, younger than that, you like, you know, 40 to 50, you become so much more sure of yourself. You've learned a lot by then. You've learned a lot by then, even to probably hear this story and just laugh at this guy and go, all right, mate, jog on.
Okay, so the next thing is Breaking Bad star Bryan Cranston has defended playing a disabled actor in his new film, saying it's an actor's job to play different people. Now, so he is playing a disabled man who, I think he's paralyzed from the neck down, I think. And this is a remake of the French film Unbreakable. Is it? No, Untouchable? Untouchable, I think, which is such a good film. It's such a good film. I love it so much. You should see it if you haven't seen it. But Kevin Hart's in this film as well, in the remake. So it looks like a good film. But people are saying, okay, why couldn't an actual disabled person do this role? Why are you doing it? And he's having to defend himself. Should he even defend himself? Because, hello, it's acting, isn't it?
I think that
he has the right to defend himself if people are going out and saying, oh, well, why is it, you know, I think he, yeah, I think he can defend himself. And it's really hard, this one, because, yes, you know, okay, did the casting people, did they look at other opportunities other than Bryan Cranston? Did they look at the disabled community? And is there an actor who, you know, not necessarily has the same disability as Bryan, as this character does, a quadriplegic, I believe it is, but has, I don't know, a similar disability, but, you know, would somebody with a disability like that, would they be able to commit to playing a role like that? Physically, could they do it? You know, they committing to, I don't know, 18 hours of filming. And Bryan Cranston comes with, you know, at the end of the day, he's a marketable actor.
Yes,
he's,
and they going want to make money.
Attract an audience.
Money. And the producers want to make money.
Yeah. So this is like, and I think he came out and said that this is a business decision. So if you look at it like that, as a black and white, you know, would a disabled person be able to put in the hours to get this shot in time, you know, on the budget and all this kind of stuff? Then you kind of think, okay, I can see why they've picked Bryan Cranston. You know, I can see that, but it does go deeper than that, doesn't it? Because I think, who was the actor that played Stephen Hawking? I forget his name now.
Eddie Redmayne or something.
I think Eddie Redmayne had the same sort of, he had the same sort of questions asked about his role. And, you know, obviously somebody is the same disability as Stephen Hawking, that would have been, it may have been quite difficult for them to play that role. But the similar thing happened to him as well, and Eddie Redmayne had to come out and say, pretty much similar to Bryan Cranston, in that, you know, actors can play many sorts of roles. But I don't know whether they even looked at the possibility of a disabled person playing this role. And it's different, isn't it? Because if somebody was playing a transgender role who wasn't trans themselves, I don't know, I understand, then it's different then in my mind, because I think, well, can you not find a transgender a transgender actor? I'm sure that's a little bit easier than finding a disabled actor to play a disabled person. I don't know why that's different in my mind, but I do understand if, you know, if there's an actor who's not trans, is playing a transgender role, why they would have, you know, I would find it hard to defend them, because yes, maybe you should go the extra mile and look for a trans person to play that trans character. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. What do you think about that, Gideth?
I think that it kind of goes back to like an old boys network. So I think in every industry, in every area, in every part of kind of your life, there is always a kind of group of people that are the kind of haves, and they kind of ride off the wave of kind of ancient superiority. And actually, Michelle Obama, in her book Becoming, talks about a very similar thing in her experience going to Princeton University. I think that there are opportunities that are there for certain kinds of people, and that opportunity is only going to be made available to certain kinds of people, i.e. people in the acting community that are very well established. You know, I don't actually watch that many movies, I have to say, but it's a big Hollywood movie. It's out there for kind of big Hollywood actors, because they need to think about long term, are they going to be generating the income after everything that they're putting through? I don't know if that just justifies it, but for me, it's how everything works in society. In every industry, there is a group of people that make the decisions. The opportunities go out to those people. If those people can't fulfill it or don't want to fulfill that role, it's then an opportunity for all. And I think that's inequality, and that's how like a capitalist society runs. It's based on how much profit you're going to make over what time frame and whether the return is going to be significant enough. So I don't know. I believe that there is a person who is disabled who could do exactly the same role, I just think that they probably wouldn't bring in the money. And it's all about money when we're living in this capitalist system. Yeah, it's not about equality. Yeah. It's not about opportunity. Do I think it's right? It's really difficult because you want kind of actors to show their kind of acting capability. But I think that when it comes to any kind of protected characteristic, I think it then goes back to people who are more likely to get opportunities over others simply because it's easier. So it's easier for a director to call up, and I don't know actually how these things work, but you know, call up an agency where they know that the actors are going to be the big Hollywood stars. There we go, we've got somebody we really like that's got a big following.
I have actually produced and directed plays in the past, right? And so I've done casting as well. And in the past, I've got like a 21-year-old to play the role of a 16-year-old schoolboy. Now, it would have been lovely to get a 16-year-old schoolboy who I think could do justice to that part, but we couldn't find anyone. And also the level of maturity, sometimes I think in that instance, I needed someone a little bit more mature and who could go on tour with the play and whatever. So that's why we ended up with an older person to play that role. And I think, and then like casting other roles as well, it's about the actor. Like that's what I have experienced. It's about the actor. Can this actor make this role shine? Can they bring something? Is my play going to be a success? Because that's what I want. And then that's what these people are thinking as well. So it's a big risk of sometimes if you're not sure about the person, you know, you need to be sure about who's playing these roles. And it's all about acting. However, I personally would have drawn the line at like whitewashing somebody, at somebody doing like blacking up and like a white person playing an Asian person just because it's like, oh, well, they're a great actor, they can play this role. I would draw the line at that. And I don't know whether I'm right or wrong for doing it, but I feel like, I don't know, it's just a personal thing. Do you agree with me? Like, what do you think about that? That someone pretending to be, not pretending, but somebody blacking up, as it were, to play somebody of a different race?
Yeah, no, I draw the line there. That is completely, yeah, that you can't do that. You cannot do that. If you need, if the story is a black character, then you would find a black character. You don't need.
But it has happened in Hollywood, though, hasn't it? Like Angelina Jolie did it for, I can't remember what film it was, but she played a mixed race woman in there. And she did get criticized for that because obviously there's a lot of mixed race actresses who are more than capable of doing that role. And then recently, Scarlett Johansson and Emma Stone both got criticized for playing roles which were apparently supposed to be, like, one of them was Japanese and the other, Emma Stone was playing a role which was, I think, like half Asian or Hawaiian or something. So there are Asian actresses that could have done it, but...
I think like race is a very different topic in that you can't kind of replicate somebody's historical racial experience that is often tied to quite a lot of prejudice. And that goes back to my point about the haves and the have-nots and the kind of legacy of advantage that exists largely for certain groups of people. So like I think that if whatever ethnicity you are, you can't then replicate somebody else's ethnicity because your ethnicity, I would say, is really strongly tied to your whole life experience. And this is why I would say I'm not quite sure if somebody who's not disabled should be playing somebody who's disabled, because that's also connected to somebody's whole life experience. It's not a kind of standalone topic that you can just kind of act out and then be done with it. Like I think it's something that comes from the heart and it really changes your whole perception on life and the way you think about things. And actually in terms of models, you'll get a lot of European models who will wear Asian clothing and will model on the catwalk or in magazines, they will model Asian Indian clothing, but they're European. So it's like you're wearing something, so you're kind of appropriating somebody's culture and their race, but actually you don't really know about it because you grew up in the mountains of Italy and actually you don't know what we wear and how we wear it and how we walk in it. And I think that that's also wrong. So I think that when you're trying to appropriate somebody's culture, I think that there's a fine line there. I think it goes on to being disrespectful.
But isn't acting different? Because acting is acting. You're pretending to be another person. So how far can you go? Can you, like a straight person can act as a gay person, then can't a white person act as a black person? I'm just saying.
No, I don't think so. I think the experience is completely different, because I think the experience of being a particular ethnicity, it comes with so much history, and it comes with so much struggle, and it comes with like a really strong personal connection and experience. And I think also physically, like aesthetically, you're not, if you're white, you can't play somebody who's black, because you don't even look. So, I mean, like the image that it gives off is just, it's a bit odd anyway.
Yeah, and it would be in mockery. You cannot authentically make a white person look like a black person without somebody just, and there's so much negative connotation with that as well. You can't get away from that. Yeah, you know?
Historically there is, isn't there?
Yeah, and people would just think it's absurd.
It's appropriation.
See what you mean with the whole, you know. It depends. I mean, this Angelina Jolie character who was supposedly to be mixed race, is that because is it a film based on a book, and the book the character is mixed race? I mean, if it doesn't matter.
It's not like in the book she was mixed race and then in the film she wasn't, because okay, that's a different thing, but she was actually made to look like a mixed race woman with her curly hair and everything, and skin tone, they changed that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, that's a bit weird, because that's almost like what we've just talked about, isn't it?
Blacking up.
And like what you're saying, Gilles, about, you know, can you really authentically play because that mixed race person, because so much of that comes from, you know, the way you live your life, the culture, your heritage, you know, all those things an actor may not be able to replicate, you know, those little nuances, those little, you know, I don't think they'd be able to do it justice. And, you know, like you said, you know, the people with the haves and the have nots, you know, why not give these people, why not give the Asian actresses the exposure? Why not give mixed race actresses the exposure? This is what it all comes down to. Like you said, it's who's a bankable star, who's going to make them money, who's going to, you know, attract people to the cinema. And it's these sorts of handful of celebrities who producers think we're going to run to the to watch, instead of watching something that's authentic, just, you know, something on, you know, new characters, new actors and things like that. It's all about money at the end of the day.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that and that it's given you some food for thought as well. You've been listening to the Sisterhood of Mommy Imperfect. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until next time, bye.